Welcome back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We are positively into the post-draft period. We're waiting on this World Cup miracle for Baltimore, as well as awaiting the emergence of Adley Rutschman potentially later on this month. But in the meantime, they're running races. The grand old game of horse racing and the Kentucky Derby this week. I'm going to be checking in with Dick Girardi and Marty McGee and some of my favorites before the Preakness 2 weeks from now. But I got a good horse racing story here from an old friend of mine. It's probably been 30 years now since this guy wrote Crown Gasoline commercials that I read along with Mark Rowe a million years ago. One of my very first sponsors back in 1993, 1994 was Crown Gasoline. Jack Gilden has gone on to do all things in PR and communications and authorship and writing books about all sorts of tender local issues in many cases. This time the book is The Fast Ride, Spectacular Bid, and The Undoing of a Sure Thing. And there's a Dundalk angle in this one as well. Jack Gilden joins us here from parts unknown here in the greater Baltimore area. What's up, Jack? How you been, brother?
It's great to see you, Ness. How have you been?
Looks like you're doing the audio version of your book. You got microphone. You looks like my old studio there at WNST.
I've been in all of your studios, Nestor, and including going all the way back to the one in Towson.
Well, none of them look as good as yours right now with all that blue behind you and all that. Writing a book, and it's always the first question, because I've written a couple of books. I literally 5 minutes before I brought you on, I got an email from the Ravens that they're doing a tribute to the Super Bowl 35 group. And they're doing that. It's like it's been 22 years now, 21 and a half years, whatever it's been. And they didn't get a chance to do the 20th anniversary because of COVID. So they're doing it down at the Meyerhof. And I think, man, that was my first mistake, writing Purple Rain 1, locking myself in a room for 100 days, locking out all playoff hockey, all girls, all fun, all concerts to get Purple Rain 1. And then I did it again. I've written 4 books total in my life. 2 have been published to, but anytime you sit and do it, whether you publish it or even if you don't publish it, you sit there and it is a very solitary research assignment. For those of us that love term papers, we like writing books, right?
I'm addicted to the wealth that comes from it.
Oh, right. Well, of course. There was so much money. Get a copy of Purple Rain 2. I've got 100 here for you if you want one.
Well, I think that we do it because there is a certain addiction in it. And when you love to tell stories, and Nestor, you've been fortunate enough to be able to interview behind the scenes and get the real story on lots of different things, the Peter Principles and these books about the Ravens, Super Bowl runs, and you know how satisfying it is to be able to kind of know that information that not everybody else gets and to then develop it into a really coherent and interesting story. And that's a hard thing to give up on.
Well, and I think for anyone, it's like seeing the original or seeing the sequel, right? Like I lived through Spectacular Bid, right? So I'm familiar with that piece of the world a little bit, but it's been 4 decades, right? I mean, since this story, give me your Spectacular Bid story because I was a, 10-year-old kid in Dundalk, I mean, I remember this.
Yeah, I guess I was about 13 or 14. I think it was a year after I was bar mitzvahed or something like that. It was so many years ago. Now I'm an old man myself. But when I, think about that story, what really pops out for me is that it had never been told correctly in all these years. So kind of the story that we got was that there was this almost magical horse. He came around in the 70s when there were 3 Triple Crown winners already before him, Secretariat, Seattle Slough, and Affirmed. And he appeared to be.
Don't forget Aladar, because Aladar would have won. I never let you forget Aladar, but go ahead.
And well, Aladar was a great, great horse. It would be a Triple Crown winner in almost any year, except
if it weren't for Affirmed. Yeah.
If it weren't for Affirmed. And I think that, you look at Spectacular Bid, and he might have been the best of those 4 horses. He was better than the other 3. And people say, what are you saying? He's better than Secretariat? Yeah, you can make a very strong case that he was better than Secretariat. The only reason that he's not remembered that way is because he lost the Belmont Stakes. And he lost it in a gigantic upset. And it was under very mysterious circumstances. The trainer, Buddy Delp, claimed a few days later that the horse had stepped on a nail in his stall the morning or the night before the race, and that he was damaged, and that was the reason why the horse had lost. almost everybody blamed Ronnie Franklin, including Delp later on, and said that he had run a poor race. And Ronnie Franklin, as you well know, Nestor, because he comes from your neck of the woods, he was just a young guy, a teenager in 1979, just like you were, just like I was.
I've never met Ronnie Franklin. I've never, you know, I mean, he's a name in the Dundalk Eagle. I saw you shared that on your Facebook.
Yeah.
He was a name from Dundalk. And listen, 1979 was just a glorious year. I mean, I was 11 years old. I was entranced by sports, right? Like, sports was everything. The Orioles, the Colts. I mean, we were 2 years out from Ghost in the Post, right? Like, at this point. So, and the buildup for what the Preakness would become for our community and what it is now, which is, you know, as we're out on it 2 weeks out, it's very sad, but it was such a big civic event. And the back end of Secretary in 73, 77 with Seattle SLU, 78 with Affirmed in Aladar, that at this point in my life, I was only 11 years old, but I didn't know anything else, right? Like, the fact that this horse race happened in May, it completely stopped our sports calendar at that time in life. It doesn't anymore, but it did then. Everything stopped. So this was a spectacular local story that dominated the news all week. I mean, this Dundalk rider was winning the Derby, then comes home and wins the it's a big friggin' story, really big friggin' story.
Because he was only a teenager. He'd only been really around horses for like 2 years or something, like 2 years or 2 years and a few months. He had never even seen a horse in person in his entire life until he was brought to Pimlico at age 15 to be a hot walker. He had dropped out of Patapsco. Did you go to Patapsco or Dundalk?
No, I didn't go to Patapsco. What's wrong with you? Dad, I went to Patapsco. Dare you insult a man like that?
He went to Patapsco, and then he had dropped out in like 10th grade or something. And then he was
like asking me if I rooted for the Steelers or the Yankees or something. Stop.
Yes, I know. I feel the same way about Franklin High School. I went to Owings Mills. But
there you go.
He was like, had very dismal prospects. His parents were concerned about him. He was only 15. He was a tiny kid. And then one of the neighbors noticed, he said, you know what? That kid is tough. He's strong. He's feisty. He would make a hell of a jockey. So he took him over to Pimlico. The guy was his father's best friend, took him over to Pimlico, and they announced him as an aspiring hot walker. The Delps picked him up, and 2 years later, he's winning the Kentucky Derby. He's coming home for the Preakness to win that as well. So it was an unbelievably magical story. And for people who are around today and don't understand the Preakness, as you were trying to kind of say it, it was like having the Super Bowl hosted here every year.
Dude, Howard Cosell came to town every year. Like, you know what I mean? Like, this was the Preakness. The fact that we've pissed it away as a community,
it's unconscionable.
Well, I mean, it's like watching you're wearing your Oriole. It's like watching an Oriole game with 8,000 people down there. It's really an incredible thing that I've witnessed over 31 years of doing this on radio and sports radio, and what sports has become and how fractionalized it is, whether you're a lacrosse person or a NASCAR person or a tennis person or a golf person. But I don't meet a lot of horse racing people anymore. And I used to. I mean, in Dundalk, people read the form. They went out, they bet. Maybe they bet too much, but they liked the action. It was the one place you could bet. Now, you know, I got Betty Boop scratch off, so I'm going to be doing it, Conrads. We all have sports wagering ears, all of these different things. But I was at the OTB at Greenmount Station 2 weeks ago with my pal Chris. People are still betting on horses and stuff. But betting on a horse because you like the color, you like to read the form or whatever, I was always a story guy. And that's why I will watch the Kentucky Derby this week. It's why I watch the Preakness 2 weeks from now. The connections, the stories that go along with it, the pageantry, the history, the fact that you dress up, wear a hat, all of that. I've been sucked into that my whole life. Maybe part of that was because Ronnie Franklin was from Dundalk and he was part of the story when I was 11 years old. And the fact that I never found him, and we lost him about 4 years ago, right? Like the fact that I never found him in life's journey. All I ever knew about him was that he had drug problems. He wasn't a very smart chap. He wasn't a really educated chap, and it didn't go well for him. And whatever was that incredible thing that was his then, it was kind of like a pitcher that lost it right away that you never hear about again. But in his particular case, I mean, it's kind of a tragic tale, right?
Well, in your recounting of it, you're kind of recounting the conventional story that had always been told. This idea that he wasn't very, very smart, that he, even that he wasn't very talented, that he was just kind of lucked into, you know, being at the right place at the right time. And he got every advantage and then he blew it all because he got involved with drugs and it was all wrecked.
Well, he's a sports legend here for me as an 11-year-old. And if he walked in right now, I'd shake his hand. I'd love to have him on the show, hear his story, talk to him a little bit. That never came to me, Jack. I never was in a room with him. I didn't know anybody that ever knew him. And I've been doing this since, you know, Jesus was a teenager. I've been doing this a long time. I've never met anybody that really knew Ronnie Franklin or would put him on the show or said he'd be a great guest, or it was never like that. He's this incredible celebrity name that I really never crossed paths with, despite the fact I'm from Dundalk and we were almost of the same age era to some degree, right? Yes. That at some point somebody at Squires or somebody would have known him or said, or Costas or whatever would have said,
Think about this, Nestor. Just as you were beginning your drive to your destiny, your success in broadcasting and things like that, just as you were beginning it in the early 90s, he had already been washed up for over a decade. And the stories about him squandering it and destroying it, those stories had already been hardened for a very long time, but they just weren't true. But nobody knew it. And so when I came into
the story, wasn't anybody like me to tell the story, right? Like he didn't come on media. He didn't show up on Vince Bagley's set or literally like he vanished. Like, and I don't even know what his voice sounded like. Like, I don't know much about him at all because he was not in the mainstream.
He had a very thick regional dialect. Like, you know, like kind of like you do and like I do. We both have.
I have no idea what you're talking about. What are you talking about?
We have it too. And he had it. He had it worse than we did even. But he had a thick regional dialect and he was a nice, happy kid. He had a good sense of humor and he was brighter than how it was reported. And he was a little bit more innocent than how it was reported. So what I had come to find and kind of peeking around the story was that it was very, very different than what you knew. So instead of him being kind of the person who was the downfall of all these things, it was actually the opposite, that he had come into the situation fairly innocent, but he had walked into a very corrupt environment when he got there. And what I try to show in the book is the years of corruption at the racetrack,
Give me corruption. What do you mean? Drug and horse? What's the real story? Did the horse really step on a nail?
I believe that he did. My only sources for it.
I know Pete Harnish stepped on the nail because Dave Johnson told me it's true.
Well, I think it's true about Spectacular Bid too, but the only people who know for sure were all in the horse's inner circle. But one of the people I spoke to was his veterinarian who operated on him after the Belmont Stakes. And he says it's true. Gerald Delp, Buddy Delp's son, the trainer's son, said it was true. Tom Meyerhoff, one of the owners of the horse, told me personally that it was true. So I do believe that it was true.
Well, then that's why the horse lost the race, period, right?
No, it's not exactly. You would think so, but it did have a big role in it because the horse was, you know, like stepping on a nail for a horse would be like you or me being like in the interrogation room at the KGB and getting like needles put under our fingernails. It's a torture to the horse. So, yes, it did play a huge role in it. But also, too, the conventional wisdom was that Franklin chased a 100-to-1 shot very early in that long, long, long race. And he chased it. That horse was in the lead. And Franklin made his move and went after it. And then by the time he hit the home stretch, the horse was exhausted. But in reality, Buddy Delp had instructed him. He said, take him away, was his advice to Ronnie Franklin. He told Jacinto Vasquez, today I'm going to beat Secretariat's record. As you recall, Secretariat was miles ahead of the field.
There's never been another race like that. Yeah.
And Jacinto Vasquez told him, you're crazy. You know, they're going to catch your ass at the end of the home stretch. There's no way you're going to beat Secretariat's record today. So they went out. That's what they tried to do. And they lost the race in embarrassing fashion. Everybody blamed Franklin for being on the drugs, you know, because a week later he was caught in Disneyland or whatever it's called in California. He was in the parking lot and got caught with cocaine in the car by a policeman in the parking lot. And that kind of began his life of spiraling out of control. He was already addicted by that point. And it all happened in the home of the trainer. The trainer, who was about 50 years old, close to 50, and Franklin, who was about 16 or 17 when he came to live in the trainer's house, they're doing cokes side by side with each other at home and other places. And the teenage sons of Buddy Delp were doing the coke, or at least Gerald was, right alongside them. So there was a lot to the story that had never been known. It had looked like Ronnie lived with Buddy Delp, and it looked like a father and son relationship to the press. And that's how it was kind of reported. But in reality, these terrible things were happening over there. He was getting hooked on the drugs, as was Gerald. Gerald was also a young teenager. And in addition to that, his money was evaporating. He was paying for the drugs and the booze that they were all taking. He was losing money in poker games to Buddy Delp. Buddy Delp was going to put down bets for him, take $2,000 from him at the track, say, "I'm going to lay it down for you." And then the money went into his pocket, never to emerge again, you know, things like that. So there was a lot of bad things going on there. By the time that kid hit the Belmont Stakes, he was practically having a nervous breakdown out there. He had had a paternity suit literally slapped into his chest in the jockey's room on the day of the Preakness. Angel Cordero, the most brilliant but a wild man out there, the jockey Cordero, he was slamming horses into him full speed out there in races. They were had an enormous rivalry going on, and it was it was a grown man in his mid-30s fist fighting in the jockey's room a kid who was 18 or 19 years old. So he had a lot on his mind. He had a lot of problems weighing him down, in addition to the addiction. And he had this man in his life, Mr. Delp, who kind of ruled over him. He owed his home to him. He owed his career to him. His standing as a celebrity, he owed it all to Mr. Delp. And Mr. Delp had this unusual power over him, and he was taking advantage of him, unfortunately.
Yeah, you're right, sir. By the way, Jack Gilden here, a local author, longtime friend of the show. You can find the book about Spectacular Bid, The Fast Ride, out anywhere you buy books. Just Google it up. You can find Jack Gilden, G-I-L-D-E-N, excuse me.
Correct.
You can find him out. So Google that up. Make sure you spell it right, Gilden. you write a book about a horse. The horse doesn't talk, right? And I would say that for the Derby week this week, or Preakness 2 weeks. And the horses don't talk. It's everybody else that has to sell it. So whether it's Bob Baffert not coming in and that affecting this, or Dwayne Lucas holding court out at the barns, or Nick Zito, or, all the glory heirs. When I would go out there and Charlie Whittingham was out there with Ferdinand and, whatever, that the trainers or the stars and the jockeys were stars, but a lot of them were Hispanic and didn't speak English well. They're little men for the most part. I don't know who the most famous jockey would be, but you know, any of the McCarrans that were out there, or any of the Stevens, or any of the
Cordero,
sure.
I mean, they were very famous. And Stevie Cawthon was a real phenomenon the year before. I mean, it was on all kinds of national.
Well, this was at a point where jockeys were famous at that, to your point.
Yes, they really were.
They were the athletes at that point. And this was a Baltimore kid, an American kid, a kid that spoke English, that was up against a lot of Latino speaking jockeys at the time, that making a star out of. The only way a trainer can be a star is to have horses that win. The only way a jockey can be a star is to have horses that win, right? So the horses have to win, but then the guy's got to be a star, and there's just so much pressure on that. And look at Baffert, right? I mean, and I don't know whether Bob's coming on or not. Bob's come on my show every year next week for the last 25 years. I mean, I call Bob, Bob comes on. Bob's not a part of this, but the reason Bob will come on is because the horses don't talk, right? Like, there is a point where your stars need to be stars, and whether they're coked up on the 79 Pittsburgh Pirates, or whether they're drugged up John Matuszak, or, whatever was going on with cocaine, steroids,
right.
The Eastern Germans were growing, women were growing mustaches when they're in the pool. All of this was going on for cheating and all of that. But horse racing needed a star, and it'd be up because Secretary didn't talk literally. Right.
Well, but the horses can have a lot of charisma. In the case of Spectacular Bid, he did his talking with his feet. And I mean, he was breaking Secretariat's records very early on, even in his 2-year-old year. He came into the Triple Crown with a streak of 12 straight stakes races. I mean, it was almost like Joe DiMaggio streak, because it's very hard to win that many stakes races in a row. And the only time it had been done had been like right in the, like the post World War II era, like War Admiral or somebody like that had had a 12 stakes race streak also. So he was a big, big star. He had a lot of charisma. I mean, he was well known, but yes, it was really up to the trainer and the jockey to do the talking for that horse. And every time they opened up their mouths, they stuck their feet in it. I mean, Buddy Delp was a motor mouth, and he created a lot of the tension that kind of came back on the jockey. He kind of wrote the checks that the kid had to cash. And there was a lot of racism involved in it, because they were, you know, after the Florida Derby, there was a lot of controversy in that race. And then they went into the jockey's room and Franklin called the Hispanic riders. You know, he used a very derogatory name that begins with an S for Hispanic people. It was despicable, and it created a lot of tension between himself and many of the best riders out there. And Buddy kind of encouraged that and pushed it on. Buddy used a racial epithet to describe Cordero. It was really even worse than the word that Franklin used. Cordero happens to, you know, he's dark skinned, like an African American. He's and also Hispanic. And Buddy kind of, you know, called him a name that would suggest that he was a chimpanzee or something horrible, you know. And it would just created gigantic amounts of tension that were coming out as violence in the situation, with the horses being used against each other, the rail, the fists were flying, all kinds of things were going on there. And at the center of it is a 19-year-old boy. You know, it was, it's, I mean, you're a father, Nestor. You've seen your son through his ages, you know, is from 15 to 19. And you know that when he's 19, he's technically an adult, but he's still a very vulnerable person. You know, I have a son who's also made it through those ages. So, you know,
Cordero had already won a couple of derbies at that point, right?
Cordero?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know if he
Cordero won on Cannonade in 74. I'm doing a reading here.
Right.
I forgot that he was on Spend the Buck as well later on, but he rode Bold Forbes in 76 and he rode Cannonade in 74. I mean, he was a made guy, and this is an 18-year-old kid from Dundalk, right?
And then Kodak the next year.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, not just a made guy. I mean, he's clearly, if he's not the greatest rider in history at that point, he's awfully close. I mean, Shoemaker's still out there, but Cordero was a breed apart from Shoemaker. He was just so aggressive, and he was so expert out there both. And he was a tough guy. The very best riders out there, including the other Hispanic riders, had a very hard time dealing with Cordero. And then meanwhile, here's this teenager, and every trick in the book is being thrown at him out there. And some of those riders were teaming up against him, colluding against him out there. And it was very hard for him to deal with it. And then when you add on to it all of these other things under the surface that he's dealing with, the pregnancy of the girl and the baby being born and the paternity suit and the drugs and the home situation, all of it, it was just excruciating for him.
Jack Gilden, a local author, writing about spectacular bid and a spectacular story of Buddy Delp. Haven't heard his name in a long time. He was always out at the track in the 80s and the 90s back in the day. You always see in the form. Delp horse back when King Leatherberry was doing his thing. Jack, I just want to talk about racing for a second I don't know of your love of it one way or another. I would say my father, and I've told this story, my father never went to the racetrack. I didn't know much about the races. I worked at the paper in 1984, the first press pass I ever had. I ran film at the News American in May of 1985. So it was the Spend the Buck year. And it was actually 84. It was actually May of 84. So it was the year before. Was that Swale? I don't know what it was. But either way, I went out and I had to run film for the News American. I had to go out and pick up bags of film canisters that were shot to get them back to the office to get them process for pictures in a special section in the News American, the Preakness hats and like all that. So I had never been to the racetrack in my life before Preakness Day of 1984. I had a car. Well, it had to be 85 because I had my driver's license. It was 85. That was 16 years because I had my car. So it was 85, no doubt. I had never been to the racetrack. And I remember I worked with Charlie Lamb, I work with Rich Petro, guys that love the track. And I started going out to the track every couple of weeks. And it was sexy to me because Vince Bagley had always read the late ponies. Race results, right?
You know,
I had a seventh
ponies.
Race and a ninth race. McCarron, he gave one another one out there. So right. So I had never been to the track because my dad just – it wasn't like Memorial Stadium for me. And I was 15, 16, 17, 18 years old. So I was learning about the form. And Charlie Ekman's teaching me stuff. And Chris Thomas is out there. And, like, people that love horse racing – and then Andy Byer shows up and Ekman's out there. And it just became like a fun thing for me to do in the afternoons. Never won a lot, never lost a lot. Had good days, bad days, always had fun. But it was an old man's game then in the late 80s. Yeah. It was starting to fall apart then. And I sat up in that old rickety press box out at Pimlico, went down to Bowie, the whole deal. I don't know how people come at it honest and I have tried for 31 years to get people interested. I've been to a half dozen Kentucky Derbies. I've been to 35 Preaknesses or whatever it's been. But horse racing is one of those things. Oh, it's May. Gildon's coming on to talk about horse racing. Isn't that cute? It'll all be gone in 3 weeks.
Right.
Horse racing wasn't that way in 1979. It is now. Where's your honest answer on your involvement in horse racing, even at that point in our life? We're both kids at that point.
Yeah.
But through the course of a lifetime, like, horse racing, something that I know Eisenberg wrote a book recently and stuff, but it is really, really vanishing, and vanishing even more quickly when I bring the Randy Mosses of the world on every year and they tell me how corrupt and dirty it is and that Baffert's been cheating the whole time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when hearing you discuss your own interest and understanding of horse racing, hearing you describe it is almost identical to my own. I mean, I was born practically in the parking lot of Pimlico Racecourse. Like every other Jewish guy in Baltimore, I was born at Sinai Hospital. You know, it's right in the parking lot of Pimlico, really. And I spent half my life driving back and forth to my grandmother's. I was living over in like the east side of town, go to my grandmother. She lived in the Hearth Sinai house over on the west side of Baltimore. And in between was Pimlico, and I would pass it all the time. And, you know, you see the jockeys out there and the colorful silks, and you see the horses. All you need to do.
The horses ran right up against the highway in Northern Parkway enough to make you like look over the fence and say, hey, you know.
And almost get into an accident as you're craning to see what's going on in there. But I got to tell you, you don't have to spend much time at the track to fall in love with it. The greatest, you know, John Eisenberg said, and he was so right about this, that the greatest stories come from the track. I mean, it's like every other sport, only 1,000% better as far as story telling goes, 1,000% better.
And the horses don't talk.
Well, the horses don't talk, but they sure get involved in a lot of weird stuff. And so do those people. I mean, the jockeys are just the greatest guys. They're so fascinating. I mean, think about the courage they have to be 110 pounds and go flying around on those things. They're fist fighting. There's all kinds of corruption going on. There's like, it's just like a tornado going on all the time there. And it's just so aesthetically pleasing. You know, it's just the most beautiful sport, really, by a mile. So there's nothing like it. I mean, you got to love it. But no, I wasn't a big horse racing person either, but I just kind of got sucked in by this story. And then I was spending a lot of time at the track as I was researching, and I fell in love with it. Let me tell you, you can walk in any track for free and spend an entire day being entertained. The food is inexpensive and better than it is at the ballpark. And it's just a comfortable place to be. The people are nice. Some of them are a little weird, but some of them are not. And it's just a fun place to hang out and talk to people and watch the action.
I love eccentric people. I've been one of them for a long time. Jack Gildon is here. He once wrote radio commercials for me with Crown Gasoline back in the early 90s. He's got a book on all things spectacular. Bid. The book is it's called Why the Fast Ride?
I love that you asked that question, because I think that most people think it's self-evident, but you're astute to ask, because I see it as multi-layered. It was the fast ride because the horse was the fastest ride anybody ever sat on. That was number one. But then it was also that kid went from never having seen a horse to winning the Kentucky Derby in about 2 years. And And his whole career, he went from being anonymous to being a superstar in 2 or 3 years. And then it was over forever for him, really. And then in the end, he ends up dying. He died when he was still under 60 years of age. I think he was like 58 or so. And so it was the fast ride of life. It went by very quickly for that poor guy. So that's why it's the fast ride.
Well, I'm trying to find the fastest rides in the history of the Derby and see all these years later, who the fastest. The fastest time was Secretariat.
It's only Secretariat.
159.40. Yeah, 159.40. Monarcos was very close. I was at the Monarcos Derby back in 01. Northern Dancer, Spend the Buck, who, of course, famously didn't come to the Preakness. Authentic a couple of years ago in 2020. But, of course, we may know in modern times, Medina Spirit. There's the black cloud around Baffert. No bueno, right? Like, no, really,
I mean,
not
me it is.
Really good, man.
So
not good at all.
Not good at all. It's he's like the Babe Ruth of his sport, but it's kind of like Barry Bonds. It's like, or even like, if you believe in the cheating around the Patriots, it's
Lance Armstrong. How about Lance Armstrong?
Lance Was he Armstrong. Legit? I mean, it's we'll right in that same thing. And for guys like us that grew up just idolizing the athletes and the coaches, and we loved it. I mean, you and I probably lived parallel lives, in the Northwest Side and Dundalk. We had all the same interests, and we loved these guys. It was all, we were so passionate about it, meant so much to us. But now, in these days, it's like a lot of it is very inauthentic. The baseball record books are destroyed that were so sacred to guys like us. The cheating that the Patriots did. How do you judge Tom Brady against Johnny Unitas when you knew that he was involved in 2 or 3 cheating scandals? Not that he's not great. We can all see he's a superb football player.
Barry Bonds was great too, but he was a cheater, serial cheater. A-Rob was great. He's a serial cheater.
I mean, think about that. That
Roger Aaron Clemens was great. He's a serial cheater.
When you and I came up in the 90s and our careers were starting to hit their stride and baseball was just ascending. I mean, the billions of dollars went into these stadiums and it was so exciting, but it was all based on a lie with all that cheating going on. So in a way, the public was defrauded for billions, for a product that wasn't what it seemed.
Well,
at least that's how I see it.
Jack, I appreciate you taking your time and diving into writing books, whether it's Johnny Unitas or whether it's a spectacular bid. Do you have another passion project at play soon?
I don't have one yet, but I can't wait to get back into it. I love to research and I love to write, and it's a lot of fun. And I like seeing you, Nestor. It's very fun. We go back so far, and we were just kids when we met, and now we're on the brink, buddy. But I'm glad that we still know each other.
It's always good to have you on, and your passion's still there for sports. Obviously, my passion is different with sports, and you mentioned writing. I'll break this to you. I have decided, and this is the first time I've said this publicly, so it is an admission. I've decided that I'm going to go back to writing more often. I mean, the last 2 years with COVID, I've been building my new business, building a crab cake tour. I'm doing 31 crab cakes and 31 breweries. We got so many awesome new sponsors. Just signed Window Nation to a deal. They're going to be sponsoring our crab cake tour as well. I have some other plans to go down to the beach and do stuff here this summer. I'm going to go back to writing because I have found, especially over the last 6 months, especially as my relationship with the Ravens has changed dramatically, their side, not mine, that I need to write about it. I need to write about memoirs and the aftermath. I find it to be therapy that if I bottle it up and I do too much thinking and I don't get it out, and I'm not a bitcher. I don't sit around to my wife and woe is me and say all the things because she lives with me. She's stuck with me. And I don't bitch out on the radio much. But from a getting it off my chest, there's nothing – it's a gift to me that I'm a writer because it allows me to emote in a way that maybe it's cathartic. I mean, I don't know what else to say. It's cathartic. And I feel like that's been a missing ingredient during the plague and this part in my life where I'm building stuff, websites, video, social, I'm tweeting in 140 characters, but there's something about taking something on and what you've done with Spectacular Bid, which is lay out a deeper meaning into a story and do some writing. I still think the most intelligent people I know like to read, and I probably want to appeal to them more than I want to appeal to the people who don't read these days. So I'm going to start writing again.
Well, I love to hear that, Nestor, because people are trying so hard to really manipulate what other people can see and hear. And if guys like us who can write choose not to, then we're giving it away. We're surrendering. And at this point, we're the guys. We're the Stedmans. We're the Oleskers. You know, we're the...
Well, the Trevor Noah thing the other day hit me too. You know, in regard to people in Russia would like to write the truth right now, but they're being threatened to be killed with the truth. And the difference maker is people here that can tell the truth. And goes for January 6th and everything else, you know, around what goes on in this country.
Too. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of intimidation and manipulation here too in telling the truth, and a lot of censorship. And whether it's on the right or the left, it's
well, I'm being bullied right now pretty heartily. So I plan to write about it. That's going to be my remedy to be
what that is.
No, I'm going to write. You'll when a time comes when I get back from my tour, I'll have some writing together in September football season. But I've been up at night writing. So, you know, I'm back on the horse. So when I began the conversation saying, hey, you wrote a book, why? Well, because you had to. That's what everybody says. You have to. So when you when you feel like you have something you have on your chest and you want to get it off, it organizes my head to write about it.
Well, it's the civilized way of making a point. You know, when you're going to disagree with other people and you do it in writing, it's the right way to do it. But I will say this, if you're being bullied because of your opinions or the things that you write or say, I don't think you're alone. There's a lot of it out there these days.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. Well, we're going to be talking more about it. Hey, and I'd love to have you back on. Hope we get a beer and a crab cake at some point down the line.
I mean, I'll stop out at one of your events soon and we'll hang out together. It's great to see you though. I enjoy watching these videos and listening to what you have to say. And I hope to see you again soon.
Hopefully you learn a little bit. Jack Gilden here. We learned a lot of bit today about Ronnie Franklin and Spectacular Bid and Buddy Delp and Angel Cordero aboard Cannonade. The horse racing's around this week, the Derby, and the Preakness is 2 weeks from now. Dick Girardi's going to join me. All my usual suspects and prospects, you know, Donna Edwards will get a call from me. Baffert will get a call from me, whether he answers it or not, be interesting. But this is going to be an interesting couple of weeks leading up to a race. We have been threatening to leave us for years and years, and we're putting the new facility together here. So I will be covering all the politics and therefore for Preakness 2 weeks from now. I am Nestor. We are WNST AM 1570 Towson, Baltimore, and we never stop talking. Baltimore positive.